morning, everyone. Heart of Souls coming out on the Monday morning, Thanksgiving week, so I can tell you're hardcore trade addicts or IPI addicts with one of you. So I want to welcome you to an event which, as you can see by the screen, is about a report we've issued recently called The Good, the Bad, the Ugly, and the Self-Destructive of Global Innovation Policy. And this is a report that is based on a lot of work we've been doing over the years looking at how countries are systemically distorting trade patterns around what we would call innovation mercantilism, using a wide array of unfair and illegitimate trade practices, including domestic policy practices, to give unfair advantage to their technology industries and give unfair disadvantage to foreign technology industries. And so what we're going to do today is have a brief presentation and report. I'll talk a little bit about the policy findings, and then we'll have three great panelists here to respond to that, and then we should have plenty of time for questions and discussion, which we'll wrap up precisely at 11:30. So I'll start on my far left. Stephen Ezell is the lead author of the report. Stephen is a senior analyst here at IPIF, focuses on innovation policy. Next to Stephen is Marcus Nolan. Marcus is the deputy director and senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics, and his work encompasses a wide range of topics, including the political economy of U.S. trade policy, the Asian financial crisis. He's written extensively on the economies of Japan, Korea, and China, and is unique among American economists who devoted serious scholarly attention to the issues of North Korea. He is also has been a senior economist at the Council of Economic Advisors, has a PhD from Johns Hopkins, and is the author of many, many books. I won't even read them all here. No More Bashing, Building a New Japan, the United States Relationship, Korea After Kim Jong-il, and a number of other books in that range. Next is Grant Aldonis. Grant is the principal managing director of Split Rock International. He is also holds the William H. Scholl Chair in International Business at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. He is also on the board of ITIF, which we thank him for. And he's also on the board of directors of the Institute for International Economic Law at Georgetown University Law Center. Grant has a long and distinguished background in trade policy. He started as a foreign service officer at the State Department, then was a negotiator with USTR, then for over a decade was a partner at the law firm of Miller and Chevalier, where he focused on trade practices. I see he was on the Bipartisan Commission on Entitlement and Tax Reform in 95, which is sort of probably was as successful as the ones we have today. But it's always good to do this about every 15 years to remind us what we should be doing but aren't. He then was the Chief International Trade Council, Senate Finance, and then in 2001 was appointed by President Bush to the Commerce Department as Undersecretary of International Trade, and now has moved on to start Split Rock International. And then finally, Bruce Stokes. Most of you also know Bruce. He's a senior transatlantic fellow now with the German Marshall Fund and a noted expert in trade, international economics, global public opinion, and European and Asian economics and trade policy. For two decades, Bruce was an international economics columnist for the National Journal, where he's now a contributing editor. He's also a monthly columnist of the European Voice newspaper in Brussels. He's written many articles, including a book, America Against the World, How We Are Different and Why We Are Disliked. He was a U.S. Japan Society Fellow, and also lived and worked and reported from Japan for a number of years. In 95, he was picked by Washingtonian Magazine as one of the best business reporters in Washington. So it's a great panel this morning. So Stephen can kick us off and just describe generally the findings of the report.
So good morning. Thanks for joining us. So I'll briefly give an overview presentation of findings from our report, the good, the bad, the ugly, and the self-destructive of innovation policy. The report examines how countries are implementing their innovation policies across 9 strategic areas. And we look at 9 areas because a country's innovation policy really contemplates how a number of different policies come together across innovation building blocks such as skills, education, and immigration, information and communications technologies, tax, trade, intellectual property, government, procurement, standards, and regulations. As if you read Finland's National Innovation Strategy, in the very first paragraph, it says that piecemeal policy measures are not sufficient in ensuring that a country maintains a pioneering position in innovative activity, and thus growth in national productivity and competitive ability. So the point is that countries with the best innovation policies are looking at how these different discrete policy areas interact with one another to create the national innovative capacity of a country. So I think we can look at countries' policies using a typology of innovation. And the point here is I think all countries have gotten the message that ultimately innovation drives long-run economic growth and quality of life improvements. So all countries are putting in place policies to move up the innovation value chain to compete and win in the highest value-added sectors of economic activity. But the point is, while everybody wants to capture that innovation, they can do so in ways that are ultimately good, bad, ugly, or self-destructive for themselves and the world. So good innovation policies are good both for the country that practices them and the rest of the world. So when countries put in place policies to increase education, to increase the global stock of knowledge, when they raise investments in basic R&D research, this is good both for them and the rest of the world. It creates spillover effects. So if a new direct discovery is found in France or South Korea, everybody, all citizens in the world, benefit from those spillovers. However, I think the issue here is that a number of commentators would say, well, any type of mercantilist innovative mercantilist practices must be bad. So if countries are using policies such as currency manipulation, IP theft, forcing IP transfer, indigenous innovation policies, a lot of commentators say that that's just bad for them and bad for the world. But the point is that there are a set of ugly practices out there that do in fact work, that will in fact help countries win in the game of international trade. But they are ugly because they contravene the established rules of the international trading system and do so in a way that the country wins, but the rest of the world loses. So any trade distorting measures that are placed on a country's non-general purpose technology, non-capital goods sector, such as information and communications technology, is an ugly practice. So if you're trying to put in place policies to move global production in automobiles or machine tools or steel or manufacturing to your economy, if you're manipulating your currency to do that, if you're stealing IP to do that, if you're forcing companies to give you their intellectual property in order to have access to your markets, those are ugly policies that will help these countries gain a competitive advantage. So they work, but they undermine the international trading system. Now, there are a set of policies out there that are bad for the country and bad for the world. I think the best example of these are the types of import substitution industrialization that countries especially such as India and the Latin American countries practiced for the past 2 decades. So principally, these entailed placing trade barriers, high tariffs on imports of general purpose technology, especially information communications technologies, products and services coming into an economy. So for example, India, in attempts to spur creation of a domestic ICT manufacturing industry, placed a number of high tariffs on imports of computer products, computer goods. Well, studies have found that for every $1 of tariffs India placed on ICT products, the country suffered a $1.30 loss to the economy overall. Well, why? Because they weren't able to import the most effective, the newest information communications technologies therefore other firms and other segments of their economy weren't able to get these latest technologies, apply them throughout their economy, and grow the productivity of their retail or their airline sector, what have you. So these are bad policies for themselves in the world. And then finally, we can think about a set of self-destructive innovation policies that are bad for the world that implements, bad for the country that implements them, but good for the rest of the world. So for example, countries that enact policies that make it difficult for them to either attract or retain high-skilled talent is a policy that's probably bad for you and good for the rest of the world. If you're a country keeping or putting in place very high effective corporate tax rates, that's probably bad for you and good for others. So the report looks at those 9 innovation policy areas against this framework of good, bad, and the other. So what we found was countries using a different set of perspectives to understand how they perceive international competition and how they compete. And here we've put in place a continuum of countries looked at in this report. And kind of the point to make here, the United States is here on the left-hand portion, and it really doesn't fully recognize that it's in international competition. It's dominated by neoclassical economic doctrines that suggest that, countries don't compete, only companies do. We find a smarter set of innovation policies coming out of the northern European countries, Scandinavia, Canada, and Australia. And these countries realize they're in a global competition for innovation, but their basis of competition is mostly predicated on innovation policy and raising their games. So when countries raise their games through good innovation policies, we all win. We're all incented to enact good innovation policies to respond to others, and we all move up the innovation value chain in a good way. Europe, for the most part, plays to win, and they generally play by the rules. Every once in a while, Europe will fall off the rails a little bit, and they'll try and reclassify information technology products to get around the ITA agreements. Maybe they'll have some data protection laws that are anti-competitive. But for the most part, Europe is on board with the rules of free and fair trade. You start to look at Brazil, India, Russia, East Asian countries, and these countries are more often subverting rules of international trade when it's to their advantage. And China is just at the far right, doing anything to win, including degrading the international system by lowering their game and lowering others' games. So when China blatantly manipulates its currency by 20 to 40%, it puts the rest of the world in a position where it feels that it also has to do so or it was falling behind. And so that causes Singapore and Taiwan and others to also start to manipulate their currencies. The point here, China, has kind of said, the United States, you're not showing us the right way forward, clearly with the economic problems you had. China's saying, we don't need your model. But our model is not the point. The point is the Swedish model, the Scandinavian model. Just because the U.S. doesn't have the right innovation policy doesn't mean China should just say, we're not going to look to good countries that could be exemplars of this. So, as Rob suggested, countries are increasingly trying to move up the innovation value chain using mercantilist technology export-led growth practices. And this technology mercantilism is a shortcut to growth, designed around the view that exports are fundamentally better than imports in achieving economic growth. And these distorting policies take a number of guises, as I said, such as pricing under cost, through dumping subsidies or currency manipulation, or policies that limit imports of other countries' products, whether through closed markets, forced technology transfer or offsets, standards manipulation, IP theft, or indigenous innovation policies. And what's interesting about countries' mercantilist practices is the differing dynamic effects they have on both foreign workers and their own workers. So what this chart here does is it looks at a set of mercantilist practices and says, okay, what is the impact on foreign workers and foreign consumers when countries put in place policies to steal IP or force inward investment? And what we find is that domestically, the impact here of foreign countries' mercantilist practices is uniformly negative on our workers. And they're for the most part neutral with regard to our consumers. Our consumers benefit when they're able to go to Walmart and buy cheaper products that have been imported from working class countries. So there is the point here is that policymakers need to understand that other countries' mercantilist practices have differing impacts on our domestic workers and our domestic consumers, and think about the political ramifications of that. Now, in contrast, the impact of domestic innovation policies in other countries on their own workers and their own taxpayers is reversed. So in those cases, for the most part, of course, mercantilist policies are positive for their workers. So when they're manipulating currencies so that they can sell products more cheaply on international markets, that boosts production, and that is good for domestic workers. However, of course, in a number of ways, those policies are bad for both consumers and taxpayers. And we include taxpayers here because a number of countries' mercantilist policies, such as if they're trying to encourage inward direct investment, they're usually giving out subsidies to attract companies to bring them there. Well, those types of wasteful subsidies are negative for domestic taxpayers slash consumers. But obviously, since countries that have manipulated their currencies are causing foreign imports to cost more, that's bad for domestic consumers. And if countries are distorting their information and communications technology marketplace, then that's also bad for consumers because it means computers cost more, they don't get the latest technology, and it's also bad for their domestic industries because they're not able to get the latest, greatest information technology products to drive productivity growth in other sectors of their economy. So the point here, I think, about trade globalization and innovation is that it has a more nuanced set of impacts on consumers and taxpayers and workers, both in domestic and foreign countries. And so we need to have a more nuanced understanding of the impacts of mercantilist policies. Perhaps the biggest mistake countries make when they implement mercantilist policies is this focus on exports. But the reality is that exports don't lead to jobs and not necessarily to higher incomes, especially for mid-sized and large nations. The notion that systematically running up huge trade surpluses is good for an economy is fundamentally wrong for several reasons. First of all, the notion that these countries have to rely on export-led growth to ensure continuing economic growth and political stability is just flat wrong. These countries could realize equal or greater economic growth if they focused on a domestic expansionary economy by raising the productivity of the domestic non-traded sectors of their economy. Moreover, this running up of huge trade surpluses is actually bad for consumers. So in 2008, China had a $426 billion trade surplus. But that trade surplus really didn't benefit Chinese citizens, because essentially that $426 billion represents value that was transferred outside the country's borders. And China's residents are actually poor by this amount. They're not better off by this amount. This production from China went to benefit other countries' consumers, not their own. So if China focused, instead of these exports, if it increased its imports, it could actually raise per capita income of Chinese citizens by 17% in 1 year, just by redirecting this economic activity from exporting it to importing it, and improving the lives of Chinese citizens by better medical equipment, by deploying better ICT infrastructure, by more cars and shoes for their people. So they don't have to grow through exports. I also think it's really important to look at this on a global level. And McKinsey released a report earlier this year called How to Compete and Grow, a Sector Guide to Policy. And what they did was they looked between the years of 1995 and 2005 at growth in developed and developing countries. So in developed countries, they looked at US, Korea, UK, France, Germany, and Japan. And they said, okay, taking these countries' initial sectoral mix in airlines, in communications, in retail, in manufacturing goods, whatever their existing sectoral mix was in 1995, said, okay, across all these countries, let's just take the average of the growth they experienced between 95 and 2005. And if we do this, we would have predicted productivity growth by sector of 1.8 to 2.3% in these economies over that 10-year period. When they look back at the actual growth, it was much more than just this narrow band of 1.8 to 2.3%. In fact, actual growth was only 0.4% in Japan and 3.3% in the United States. And what this means was that our sectors were outperforming other country sectors in terms of productivity. So the message is that it is the productivity of a nation's sectors that matters much more than its mix of sectors. So instead of countries trying to focus on shifting the global location of activity, shifting global production to their shores, they should focus it on raising productivity. And lo and behold, these findings also hold for emerging countries. So when the numbers were examined for China, India, Mexico, Russia, Brazil, and South Africa, the predicted growth band would have been between 5.2 and 5.9%. Instead, the actual ranges were 3.5% productivity growth in Brazil to 9.1% in China. So the point is, these countries as well can grow by raising domestic productivity. So two other large mistakes that countries make are, as I said, applying working plus policies to their capital goods sector, especially IT. We've seen India, Turkey, China, and Argentina be guilty of this. Just like India, Argentina has tried to spur the creation of a domestic indigenous ICT sector. In their case, they've done so by imposing tariffs on assembled computers, but not placing tariffs on computer parts. Well, what has it left Argentina with? Essentially, it's left them with a pretty inefficient ICT marketplace in which, in fact, one-third of the computers sold in Argentina were assembled by hand. So these are pretty ineffective machines, and they don't help to raise the productivity of other sectors of their economy. And overall, this failure to focus on non-traded sectors. In South Korea, for example, the per capita value added of their wholesale retail sector is just 30% of U.S. levels. Overall, in South Korea, their productivity levels are 50% of U.S. levels. Look at Japan. Despite the presence of some world-leading industries in manufacturing, consumer electronics that have the greatest productivity levels in the world, Japan's overall productivity level is just 70% of U.S. levels, and it's even worse in developing countries. India has productivity levels, economy-wide, just 8% of the United States. China's are just 14% of the United States. So these countries can grow dramatically if they just focus on domestic growth of their non-traded sectors. And I think this becomes critical with regard to information technology. If you try and explain the difference in growth in the United States versus the Japanese economy since 1990, you see that it almost entirely comes down to the firm's effective use of information technology. So in fact, differences in IT use at the firm level in the US and Japan explain for Japan falling from 86% of US productivity levels in 1990 to under 80% today. So the message here, I think, is that as much as 80% of the value of information technology comes from its use, not its production. As Eric Brynjolfsson said in his book, Wired for Innovation, it's how Walmart uses IT to transform the retail sector, not where that IT came from or where it is produced, that has driven the productivity growth in our retail sector. So this is the message we need to give to other countries. The final message I want to make about export-led growth policies is that they're fundamentally unsustainable, both for the countries themselves and for the rest of the world. Right, the Brazilian currency minister said, we're all in a bind, right, because everybody is trying to sell. Well, it may have worked for Japan or South Korea to use export-led growth strategies to close the gap after World War II. But if China and everybody else in the world is going to try and rely on it, there's just not enough demand at this point in the United States and the European Union for that type of policy to be sustained. So it's unsustainable for the world and for the countries themselves. If you look at what's happening in the South Korean and Japanese economy right now, they've entered kind of a state of malaise for several reasons. But one of the reasons why is that service sectors are critical intermediate industries for manufacturing sectors. So if you start to have an uncompetitive service sector, because finance and design and R&D and retail are inputs to your manufacturing sectors, over the long term, your manufacturing sectors can become globally less productive if you don't have competitive service sectors. So ultimately, kind of China's on a path to be a Japan. They might catch up to the technological frontier, but you know, they might get stopped there. So ultimately, the message here is that if we are going to achieve globally balanced and sustainable growth, countries are going to have to ditch sole reliance on export-led growth strategies and move to growing their economies through increasing the domestic productivity of their non-traded sectors. Thanks.
Thank you. Before I turn over to the panelists, I want to talk a little bit about what are the policy implications of all of this. So I think policy implications are twofold. One, domestically, in the U.S., we really don't think this is a problem. And internationally, most countries don't think this is a problem. And that's really the challenge. So I was on a panel recently with the head of the broadband strategy for Brazil. And after the panel, I asked him how things are going. He said, well, you know, things could be going better. I said, why? He said, well, it's really hard to convince policymakers in Brazil to have a national broadband strategy and get broadband expanded throughout our country, because all they want to think about is where can we get jobs in the short run, and the best way to do that is to give a whole lot of subsidies to Embraer and these other exporting firms, because then we know we're going to get jobs right away. So all these countries are sort of in a box, you know, they put themselves in this mental box, this policy box, and they can't get out. Here in the U.S., a few years ago, we had done some work on this, and so I was at a dinner, and there was a member of Congress giving a talk, and after the talk, we could ask questions, so I asked a question, and I said, listed sort of all of these practices, and I said, don't you think these practices are problematic for the U.S. and that we should do something about it? And he looked at the thought for a minute, and he goes, well, you know, we all know Adam Smith said that mercantilists only hurt themselves, so I don't really think we should do anything. These countries are just deluded and they're hurting themselves, and if they want to do that, that's their business. So there's a sort of fundamental denial in the U.S. that in his view, all of these practices were in the bad box, or even the self-destructive box. They certainly weren't in the box of hurting us. Actually, I guess they would be all in the self-destructive box for that person. Another example recently, I won't say who this was, let's just say really, really, really prominent economist who happens to be in power right now, who I was told in the meeting said, we don't really need to worry if the Chinese want to subsidize their clean energy industry because American consumers benefit. So they want to have all these policies. We don't really care. So now if you go back to this, what that person was referring to was that top line and really just thinking only of the green. Why bother? Why not worry about it? Well, the answer is because those policies hurt U.S. workers. They're not just about benefiting U.S. consumers. The Chinese aren't stupid. They're doing these subsidies because ultimately, as any kind of predatory pricing monopolist would do, they think they're going to gain market share in the long run. So what do we need to do? Okay. We need to do, I think, several things. The first major thing we do is we need to develop a global consensus of what's going on and why it's bad. And frankly, I think the administration's been working in that direction, but it's something that we can't do alone. We've got to bring in other countries who see the world the same way we see the world. And I am going to be chauvinistic here for a second. I do think that the way we see the world is better than the way China sees the world. I think that we and the Brits and the Australians and a bunch of other countries are committed generally to open trade and playing by the rules. And I think we need to set that as a standard. Now, to Stephen's point, I wouldn't go so far as to say that we're the ultimate model. I do think that other countries that are more willing to say, yes, you know what, we need a proactive innovation policy. We need a better R&D tax credit. We need to invest in science funding. We need to have policies, a national broadband policy, things like that. Those are all sort of good. Second thing we need to do is when you look at sort of why countries do this, there's no downside to them. You know, the risk of, A, you might occasionally get a WTO case slapped on you, and the odds of winning that are actually pretty high. And even if you lose, not much often happens. So the downside of doing this is close to zero. And the upside, as Stephen alluded to, is quite high. So that's why countries do it. They're rational in the current system of what the rules of the game are. So we need to start changing the rules of the game. One place to do that would be for the IMF to basically say, we are going to put countries on a blacklist, and if your raison d'etre, if your entire organizing principle for your economic policy and innovation policy is mercantilism, good luck, you're on your own. We're not going to help you. World Bank is not going to help you. We are going to cut you off. AID is not going to help you. And we will instead devote our resources to supporting those countries that generally do a good job. So an example would be Chile versus Argentina. We should be helping Chile. Chile is a country that really does try to play by the rules. Argentina is a country that has no interest in playing by the rules. So why don't we send a message about with some incentives towards that? Third thing we could do is we need to be much more aggressive at bringing WTO cases. We don't really do anywhere near enough of that. We need to expand USTR. Part of this is a resource issue. But we've got to raise our game in the sense of going after other countries that are systemically cheating. Now, it was very good that we won the ITA case recently. This was a case that Stephen alluded to, the Information Technology Agreement, one of the best trade agreements ever signed. And yet the Europeans were systemically manipulating it by calling a 21-inch LCD monitor a television. If you call it a television, you can slap a 14% tariff on it. So we acted, finally. We took a case. We won. We won decisively. And hopefully that will mean that they stop doing that. But that's just one of many, many kinds of examples. The problem is that we end up playing this whack-a-mole case. We're like, oh my gosh, the Chinese are doing this new thing. Why are we surprised? So when the Chinese did their value-added rebates on semiconductors, and we forced them to not do that, and now they're going back and trying to do it a different way, we're all surprised that the Chinese are doing this. The Chinese main goal is to do this on a regular basis. Now they've switched over to indigenous innovation. So it's not as if they're going to stop. It's not as if these are anomalous cases that come up one at a time and we win them. These are systemic patterns that I would argue we've really got to be much more systemic on. And the last point would be, I think it's worth talking about a new kind of trade partnership. So recently the administration talked about a trans-Pacific partnership where we would bring in a bunch of countries in the Pacific region, mostly APEC countries, I believe, which I think is a really good idea. I think it's a great idea. But one thing I would do with that would be say, you can't join this club if you're a systemic mercantilist. You can join the club if you renounce mercantilism. Hi, I'm Zimbabwe. I used to be a mercantilist, and now I'm not. And if you do that, then you get to join the club. In other words, I think it's really time to say at the end of the day, we really don't need to do this in the world. These other countries can grow systemically without having to do these kinds of practices. And I think as the world leader in terms of so many areas, I think it's incumbent upon the U.S. to move everybody in that direction. So, with that, thank you very much, and we will go in order. Grant, why don't you go first?
Sure. Well, first of all, thank you, Robin. Thank you, Stephen. It's a great report. I might have some differences about the weight on some of the recommendations, but I fully embrace the underlying analysis. The striking thing about reading this and thinking about what countries have done with innovation policy is that they've learned one lesson, which is that along with Paul Romer thinking hard about growth and how growth theory has sort of emerged over the last 20 years, it's driven by innovation. It's driven by changes in entrepreneurial decisions, actually, that then create a flow through the rest of the economy that raises productivity as a whole. What it sadly does is ignore the lessons of that, which is you create that opportunity rather than providing an offset or an advantage to an existing enterprise. And what that means is that set-asides, subsidies, standards, trying the value-added rebate on semiconductors and a variety of other things doesn't actually yield the innovation that drives productivity. What you really have to do is systematically align the incentives in your own economy in a way that fosters entrepreneurial innovation. And what that means as a practical matter is you need to be making your economy, since this is the real basis of global competition at this point, attractive to capital, talent, and ideas. And the individual set-aside, particularly, let me take the Chinese example, that helps a red-chip company compete against some of the best companies in the United States is not actually encouraging the kind of entrepreneurial innovation from the bottom that would drive productive changes through their economy. What it's designed to do is create jobs. And particularly in the setting we're in right now economically, everybody wants to create jobs. What we largely ignore, again, flowing from growth theory, is what actually creates jobs. And at the end of the day, it is a productive entrepreneurial economy, not one that is trying essentially to shift employment from consuming countries to producing countries, which is what a mercantilist policy tries to do. And there, I think the report is absolutely accurate. At the end of the day, it actually requires, and this is the leap for policymakers and politicians everywhere, into the unknown. It is having the belief that embracing creative disruption is the right set of policies and practices at the end of the day, which is a hard thing to do. I mean, ironically, it's sort of hardwired into our Constitution with a patent law, a commerce clause, a variety of things that we don't think of as institutional incentives, but nonetheless provide a framework in the United States for a contestable market and fosters a lot of what we think of as innovation. We have a tendency to overlook that, as do, I think, other countries in terms of the basis that provides for what drives a lot of what has been our success over time. Now, from the point of view of what kind of challenges raises, the first thing is the challenge conceptually of saying the policies that you're doing will shift employment from one country to another, and that's going to aggravate tensions in the global trading system, but it's not going to create jobs net, on a net basis. What you're going to end up with is a zero-sum game. And our job should always be to try and create a positive sum outcome as a part of this process. Otherwise, we're going to continue to have the friction and things will be in a negative spiral. What's interesting about it, though, is that these are not, here I might differ a little bit with Stephen, these are not actually practices oftentimes that do violate the rules. What we should understand in the global trading system is that it focused laboriously on trying to remove tariffs, which were the principal obstacles that were imposed in 1930 in the middle of the Great Depression. What they don't really cope well with are things like an indigenous innovation strategy. And the truth is that, and here I'm going to take a little bit of a hit at the Obama administration, to grapple with the issues that make the largest difference to our economy and to our trade, an enforcement strategy alone will not work. At the end of the day, you have to be at the negotiating table trying to create the rules that actually provide for a contestable market and start to weed out the kind of mercantilism that Rob was describing. And many of the recommendations reflecting the report, as well as what Rob was talking about, really embraces that. How do you systematically go after this approach rather than making it an individual case about value-added taxes, whatever it might be? Now, there's one other challenge that flows from that, which we learned, and this has a pattern that has gone on forever. For those of us who are old enough, we've been through steel, we've been through semiconductors, we've been through textiles, we've been through everything. There always is a part of the world that will subsidize the competition, and there will always be some very good economist in power who will tell you we should, you know, we don't care if it's microchips or potato chips, that was the Boskin line, you know. We should just gratefully accept the largesse of the Chinese people, Larry Summers line. You know, it just sort of goes from one to the next. What we have a tendency to ignore is that, and should know, about the imperfections of markets is that once the capacity is built in response to these incentives, it takes a very, very long time for the market to clear that capacity. And what's interesting about that is that those companies that depend entirely on private capital markets rather than government support may not necessarily be the winners. The innovative companies may be the net losers in that sort of environment. And so on a whole range of issues, you're looking at a global economy that's far less productive, far less innovative, and not serving the interests of the people at the bottom of the pyramid. Which ultimately, when you start to get into this game of simply shifting employment from one country to another, is what you're doing. You're not actually creating jobs, you're just shifting employment. And so at the end of the day, the net losers are always the people at the bottom, regardless of which country you're talking about. Now the interesting thing about this is that what we have to realize from a challenge, not from the point of view of the global trading system, but from the point of the United States, is that our first obligation has to be to create a domestic innovation strategy that actually contributes to fostering the dynamism in our own economy. I think that one of the lessons of this report for me was that we don't have an innovation strategy worthy of its name, right? And I know there's a lot of good work of ITIF and Rob and Stephen over time, but the reality is we don't. And until we do, and until we've thought through the consequences of adapting the right strategy to encourage entrepreneurial innovation, we will not be in the game, because we won't have the concept that underlies the real success of many, many American firms that have created the world that we know. So, ironically, we're ignoring our own history, and as a consequence, referring to your comments with the congressman, Rob, we're not actually understanding what we should be doing for the benefit not only of American companies but American workers. And then internationally, I have to say, until you have a conscious and intentional strategy of trying to create a system of rules that does clear this stuff out of the system, and you're at the negotiating table constantly trying to encourage that on a global basis, a regional basis, wherever you can, you're not going to succeed, even if you adopt an effective innovation strategy of your own. So at the end of the day, my own view is you don't get far by playing whack-a-mole. You don't get far in terms of a lot of countervailing duty or anti-dumping cases. What you have to actually do is create an environment, this goes again to Rob's good point, that is an incentive for the outliers to come into a system that embraces the kind of entrepreneurial innovation that actually will drive global productivity over time. So in my own view, Asia is the right place to start, because that's where we have a number of the problems. We have one good thing going for us, which is the Chinese policy. In a weird sort of way, what they've done is they've tried to raise Chinese companies in the regional value chain in Asia, so they're no longer the final assembly point, is they've really upset the regional value chain. The opening of Asia's market regionally allowed countries to find themselves a spot in the regional value chain. And as a consequence, China's upsetting that now, and that means they're open to new ideas. It's time for us to actually create what I would describe as not a free trade agreement, but a common commercial environment, where the underpinnings of that common commercial environment embraces exactly the sorts of rules you described.
Great. Okay. Thank you, Grant. Marcus.
Thank you. It's a great honor to be invited to participate in this panel. It's an excellent report that has a lot to commend it, and I urge you all to read it in its entirety. One of the things that I found so nice about it is that it avoids the kind of techno-fetishism that I think work on innovation has an unfortunate tendency to lapse into. And instead, clearly and I think correctly recognizes that technology and productivity and innovation really should be embedded into a broader discussion of economic life, because ultimately what we're interested in is not technology per se, but we're interested in economic welfare and prosperity. And I think the report does a really good job of that. It has a very broad view, integrating not only things about the U.S. economy, but the global economy broadly. In my remarks, basically, I like to organize it in two parts. One is, or three parts. One is to first step back and basically just say, in my own words, a bunch of things that Stephen said, just to reinforce them. Talk a little bit about some particular issues of political economy, focusing on Northeast Asia, because that's something I know something about. And then finally pick up on Grant's point about the policy recommendations that Rob raised at the end. So the basic point of economic life is to deliver prosperity and material well-being to people, and technology and innovation have a role to play in that. But raising productivity, while partly a function of technology or innovation, is narrowly construed, is part of a broader process of changing the composition of economic activities, and as Stephen really emphasized in this presentation, really putting those technologies and innovations to use outside the sector in which they were developed. I mean, that's really what we're trying to accomplish. And that leads us to a very broad consideration of policy that, even focusing on the traditional innovation aspect of increasing productivity, a panoply of more generic factor market policies in the labor markets and capital markets could have a major impact both on the development of technology and its diffusion throughout the economy. So examples would be financial market policies that support the commercialization of innovation that may occur in universities or national research laboratories or other non-commercial institutions. This is not so much an issue here in the United States, but turns out to be a big issue in Japan and South Korea, is labor market policies that allow people to move between the commercial sector and the university sector and research laboratories and so on. One of the problems that those countries have confronted is they basically have a pension system that locks you into a single institution for life. And so it essentially discourages people from moving, it discourages startups. Here in the United States, an aspect of labor market policy that the report mentions would be immigration policy, which is going to be more of an important policy in Northeast Asia in the future. And if you put them both together, the example I used of financial market policies and these labor market policies, you basically want to have your factor markets operating in a way to encourage startups so that people can leave large corporations, go out on their own. They have the money, they're able to hire people, and they can start up their own enterprises. As the report observes, this is particularly important in the service sector, which tends to be domestically oriented and sheltered from international competition. The facts with regard to South Korea, for example, are even worse than the report mentions. Depending on how you model the econometrics, South Korea has been experiencing total factor productivity growth in the manufacturing sector. It's been positive. Depending on some specific assumptions you make, it may be a relatively small or a relatively large positive number, something on the order of 3-4% a year for the last 25, 30, 40 years. During that same period, total factor productivity growth, that is to say, the increase in efficiency once the inputs of labor and capital are taken into account, has actually been negative in the service sector. That is to say, the South Koreans today in their service sector are getting less bang for the buck than their parents did in the 1970s. Okay? And that domestic service sector is really important. Not only is it a large part of the economy, in the specific case of South Korea, it's likely to be a growing part of the economy. As the manufacturing sector may shrink due to competition from China, and the rapidly aging population is going to be demanding more and more services, fewer manufacturing goods. So I was on a panel on Thursday afternoon, and setting aside some possible contingency with respect to North Korea, I said the single biggest challenge for the South Korean economy over the next 20 years is dealing with a nexus of issues having to do with the aging population and the absolute imperative to increase productivity growth in the service sector. I don't know how many people here have cell phones with them today that were either designed or manufactured in South Korea. We all know that in a narrow sense, their strides in information technology have been absolutely astounding. But when you look at the domestic service sector, it is simply an anchor around the ankle of that economy. And you could say the same thing about Japan. Unfortunately, you will probably be able to say the same thing about China in 10 or 20 years, where productivity growth in the manufacturing sector, in tradables, which is subject to international competition, grows rapidly, but the domestic service sector, which is really important to people's lives, lags behind. The point of this sort of lengthy preamble is to simply underscore that promoting innovation and productivity is more than simply focusing on technology. And as I said at the outset, this is something that this report does really well, to embed those important concerns in a kind of broader rubric. Now, presumably one of the reasons the organizers invited me to come here this morning was because I've done work on Northeast Asia, particularly on Japan, South Korea, and Taiwan. And as the report correctly observes, my estimation, at least the historical experience of these countries with regard to their technology policies has been a mixed one. The key value, I think, of looking at these historical cases is the insight that it may provide for dealing with the contemporary and future challenges we face for both those countries, but other rising countries such as China and India. Basically, there are two points that I would like to convey. The first is that each economy has a different institutional setup. And so the policies that were applied historically and the policies that are going to be applied in the future are going to reflect those different different institutional environments. So that when you say good, bad, ugly, there is not going to be a single good, bad, ugly framework globally. Or another way of putting it, you may have a common set of principles globally, but where the rubber hits the road in trying to work out the tensions, they're going to vary country to country because these policies are coming out of countries with different institutional environments. In the case of Japan, for example, we often think of Japanese industrial policy promoting supercomputers or something of that sort. Well, if you look carefully at what actually was done, most of the resources went into declining natural resource sectors such as rice farming and coal mining. And the reason was very simple, political economy. Those were large, well-organized sectors, and they were able to pressure the government for resources. The manufacturing sector was actually taxed on net to provide those subsidies. And the sort of industrial policies that we focus on in, say, supercomputers were really almost compensatory. The report, I don't think, ever uses the phrase general equilibrium, but it's implicit in some of Stevens' charts that you can't just look at where the money is going. You have to look at where it's coming from. And in all these countries, where it goes and where it comes from is a function of domestic political economy. There is no reason to believe that Indian or Chinese or American policies moving forward are not going to reflect similarly parochial domestic political calculations, though they will be distinct. That is one reason why I think the report is really to be welcomed in its urging of development and strengthening of international norms. And here's what here's the final part I want to pick up Grant's point on rules enforcement. The problem is we don't have any rules at this point, and the most natural institution for developing those rules, the WTO, is in the midst of a negotiation which is dead in the water. Bruce and Grant can express that in more sophisticated terms, but as far as I can tell, the Doha Grant is going nowhere. So this is a real problem if the basic venue where you want to work this stuff out seems to be experiencing a real existential problem. So let me just raise a possibility, which I think in some ways would be attractive, and in other ways I suspect Rob might have some disagreement. That is, if you need to work out these norms, one possible venue is the G20. The reason is you've got all the major players. Now, they're not the lineup of good guys, right? I mean, China's in there, India's in there, but in some ways that's okay because those are the guys ultimately you're gonna have to deal with. So one possibility would be try to start working out these norms and rules which don't exist in that venue, and then you could try to institutionalize them through the WTO or through some other organization. One possibility in the meantime, before you have all those rules fully articulated, would be to establish a wise man's group. To name and shame, and say, we don't know, we don't have a rule yet on what's good, bad, and ugly, and self-destructive, but that looks pretty ugly, and that looks pretty self-destructive. And that would be a way of trying to, beginning almost immediately, to bringing some discipline to the system in the short run, while we're working out the fully articulated set of rules and norms that the report calls for. Again, this is an excellent report. I would urge you all to read it, and thank you very much for allowing me to participate in this program.
Mark, thank you so much, and with that, we'll hear from Bruce, and then over to questions.
Great. Like my fellow panelists, like to thank Rob and Stephen for inviting me here. It was an excellent report. I commend it all to you. I read it, and it's fully expected to engage with Mark so eloquently described as technological fetishism, you know, kind of how do we, and it actually is a much broader report, and I think it was a much more useful contribution to the dialogue. Because there's limited time, and the topic is so vast, and there's no way to be comprehensive in my comments, so I'd like to be a bit provocative and then hopefully throw this over to the discussion. I'd like to comment on just two issues. One is the focus the discussion a bit not only on innovation that's technology oriented, but to remind ourselves that it's process innovation, not just product innovation, that is terribly important to the improvement of productivity, especially process innovation in the manufacturing sector, which is still a major contributor to our productivity growth, and then what role and what are the implications of trade policy in that process. To that end, it seems to me, I think we need to remind ourselves of the importance of the preservation of the industrial commons in the United States. And by the industrial commons, I mean what Garrett Pisano and Willie Shih of the Harvard Business School refer to as those core industries and the small and medium-sized companies that cluster around them and feed off each other in a symbiotic relationship with their attendant entrepreneurial managers and skilled workforce. And that it's that ecosystem, that industrial ecosystem, that fosters much of the productivity that, as Mark has said, I mean, if we can have productivity without technology, that'd be fine. I mean, the point is that we need to foster that productivity. Andy Grove, the founder of Intel, a very provocative piece in Business Week about 6 months ago, said that industry needs an effective ecosystem in which technology and know-how accumulates, experience builds on experience, and close relationships develop between supplier and consumer. And that requires the continued existence of manufacturing in the United States at some level. Technological innovation occurs through human interactions in this industrial ecosystem, not just in the laboratory, in the minds of a few scientists. As Greg Tuzzi, National Institute of Standards has written, knowledge underlying emerging technologies requires person-to-person contact and interactions among manufacturing industries and between manufacturers and services. Innovation policy that does not preserve that industrial commons, I suggest to you, may fail. However, moreover, entrepreneurial innovation, especially process innovation, rarely occurs in a vacuum. Warps off an existing industry. What that means in the real world is that a few friends think they can build a better widget, and they leave their current employer, and they go off and they start a new company. That happens again and again in the United States, as in the past, and has been a source of a great deal of our productivity growth. In the 1970s, for example, the founders of Penn United, a precision machining company in Cabot, Pennsylvania, that I visited earlier last week, did just that. They spun off from Oberg Industries, which was another precision manufacturer down the road. Penn United now employs 550 people in Western Pennsylvania. It's a thriving enterprise. Ironically, Oberg, the company they spun off from, had in the late 1940s spun off from Allegheny Ludlum Steel, creating their own precision machining. So this process feeds on itself, and one of the challenges we face is to preserve that environment in which that process can take place. Absent that, in the future, it seems to me, once American manufacturing enterprises have moved abroad, the process innovation and the entrepreneurial innovation that comes off of those processes will take place elsewhere. And it won't be American entrepreneurs leaving their company, starting small and medium-sized firms, contributing to the productivity of the United States government economy. It will be Chinese entrepreneurs creating their own companies, as is the natural process. And I think we can't lose sight of that importance. Moreover, without a substantial manufacturing presence in the United States, we will, it seems to me, lose the potential for the kinds of both process and technological innovations that have driven the economy in the past. As Pisano and Shih have written, in reality, there are relatively few high-tech industries where the manufacturing process is not a factor in developing new, especially radically new, products. So that link between process technology and technological innovation itself, it seems to me, is terribly important. For example, Pisano and Shih cite the movement to China of U.S.-based semiconductor manufacturing and the production of flat panel displays for computers and TVs. Many American economists dismissed concerns about such outsourcing, arguing that such activities were not core manufacturing activities going forward. But experience making chips and screens gave the Chinese expertise in processing ultra-pure crystalline silicon into wafers, and experience applying thin films of silicon onto large glass sheets. the Chinese have now parlayed that experience and expertise into a highly competitive solar panel industry. So one does lead to the other. We have to be very conscious of that. So I would argue that a critical mass of domestic manufacturing matters for future process and technological innovation, and that leads us to the kinds of trade policies that might preserve that industrial commons. I think we have to start with, a reality that we've learned from the financial crisis and the unsustainable level of our current account deficit that preceded the financial crisis, and that is that America needs to make more of what it consumes, and not only to rebalance the current account, but also to assure a dynamic, innovative environment in the United States. As ITIF has noted, currency policy matters, and a fairly valued dollar is critical to ensuring that the technologies produced and sourced in the United States and that foreigners choose to manufacture them here. But recent experience with the euro suggests that this is a bit beyond our control. That, as you will know, until November, we had a weakening dollar against the euro, and then a year ago, all of a sudden, the dollar began to strengthen against the euro over things that we had no control over. So I think there's limits to currency policy, although it's very important. We also need a government policy, especially when dealing with countries like China that have not signed the WTO public procurement code, to encourage the purchase of manufactured goods in the United States using taxpayer money. This is WTO legal when we deal with countries like China. It also sends a message to our supply chains that there's a future to business in the United States, which is terribly crucial for manufacturers thinking of where to place manufacturing in the future. No longer should the immediate cost savings of imports be assumed to outweigh the benefits of preserving the industrial commons. It's the value of the industrial commons is obviously somewhat intangible, but I think that in the spirit of broader discussion of this report, we need to begin to try to understand it has value and that the bottom line economic analysis of wherever the lowest price is where we should put manufacturing is a policy destined to sacrifice innovation going forward. China has long leveraged American and European firms to invest in China if they want to sell there. So it's time, it seemed to me, that we practice a bit of the jiu-jitsu ourselves. As an example of this, I would point out to you in August, the United Steelworkers convinced a Chinese windmill firm to buy from American suppliers many of the components for a Texas wind farm that they were building. The Chinese agreed to do this because the steelworkers said they would tie them in court for years if they didn't. It's the kind of creative use of leverage that I think we need to exercise more fulsomely. Finally, it seems to me, I agree, I think we need international cooperation and negotiation and problem solving going forward. I would suggest that we work more closely with the Europeans to create common technological standards for the transatlantic market, which is still by far the largest market in the world. If we don't, we risk the Chinese setting those standards for us. And if you don't think that's important, just ask Apple and their efforts to get the iPhone approved in China. That, I think, is a roadmap for what's ahead if we do not develop our own standards. And I would say, inter alia, that's going to be very difficult because at the end of the day, the Europeans and the Americans have different views on standards. And we're not, in theory, we should be able to work together. In practice, it can be much more difficult. With that, I'd like to close. I hope I've been provocative enough to stir somewhat of the conversation here. And thank you, everybody.
Great. Thank you, Bruce. So we have about 20 minutes. I'm going to turn it over to all of you. If you have a question, just raise your hand and also identify. So I do want to say to Alton Mark that I don't think I disagree with you at all on the G20 thing. I don't think we've been systemic about how we think about using the G20. We need to find some allies who would agree with us before we go into those meetings and then make that a major focus of it.
Why don't we go back? Bill, we'll go here. And do we have mics? Mics are not working today, so we'll have to be Dan, for yourself, Bill.
Bill Rice, the National Foreign Trade Council. to ask a provocative question. I was intrigued by Bruce's speech. I gave the same one in the 80s, and nobody paid any attention.
So I don't want to listen to that.
I guess the question, which is builds off that, is probably more for Rob, but for anybody. Isn't it too late to recapture what Bruce says needs to be recaptured because so much of the industrial base has gone somewhere else? And B, it's not too late. Don't we have to do the very things that the report criticizes other countries for doing in order to succeed?
I don't think it's too late. It's too late for certain sectors that probably we never would have had competitive advantage in any way, like low-skill commodity textiles. We're not going to get those back. Probably shouldn't get those back. There are a whole set of other industries that we still have here that are more capital-intensive, that are more knowledge-intensive, and more skill-intensive that I do believe we can gain global market share if we had more favorable policies, both domestically as well as internationally. For example, in our view, we should have first-year expensing of new CapEx for all manufacturers, all companies. That would a better R&D tax credit, those kinds of policies. And then do we have to do the same thing? Look, I think one of the problems is the U.S. has the best non-traded sector, I would argue, in the world. Our productivity is better than almost anybody, maybe a few little teeny countries like Finland or something. We have the best non-traded sector. We don't have the best traded sector, and we're sort of almost the yin and the yang of these other countries where they've got great traded sectors and abysmal non-traded sectors. So I don't think it's a problem if we take some more active steps. I know that several people, like Prestowitz, for example, has argued we need a national program to give subsidies or incentives to U.S. companies so they don't go offshore if they're in these big, they're comparing a deal from Japan or a deal from Europe. We need to put something on the table as well. So I think there's lots of things we can do that aren't, problematic in that regard. But I think unless we also, we need to do two things in the country, and we're not doing either one of them well: develop a strong and robust national innovation policy and develop a better approach to these other countries, which is what Grant, Marcus, and Bruce talked about. Let's go to
Graham, if I could just add on that.
We've got to go in order.
The thing that strikes me is that we have a tendency to overlook that while the world economy has grown dramatically in the last 30 years, the American share of manufacturing has remained the same by value. And the mix within that has changed a lot. But we have a tendency to overlook the fact that our manufacturing sector is still larger than every economy except Japan and China.
So does that mean you don't agree with Bruce?
I don't agree that we're losing the industrial commons, but I agree that if we're not very careful about this set of policies, that we do risk slowing away. And as you and I have talked about many times, because the world is dominated by global supply chains at this point, if we're not very conscious of making sure that we keep building those clusters of innovation in the manufacturing sector, that we could lose that. My own sense is, really, I was just to say, Bill, I don't think it's too late by any stretch of the imagination, but I do think we're in a precarious position precisely because with enough government support, a firm in China can outlast a very competitive and innovative firm in the United States at the end of the day and capture market share and shift employment. The other thing is, what do you do? And what I don't necessarily embrace is the idea that we have to adopt either Clyde strategy or mercantilist strategies of our own. A good starting point, for example, would be a tax code on the foreign side that actually adopted territorial limits and the water's edge concept so that we don't penalize American companies, particularly innovative American companies, from competing for the growth that lies outside our borders, which is what we do now, and the administration is actually shifting it further in that direction with its own budget proposals. Also, when you start to think about some of the things people have talked about, how we grapple with fiscal problems, like a value-added tax or a national sales tax on top of what we're doing now, it's important to remember that from the point of view of the guys at the bottom, that means for the entrepreneur, he's paying tax from day one rather than going the direction that Rob wants, which is to make sure he can expense everything against income and actually carry that forward so when he's earning income, he still has that tax break available to him. So there's choices that we could make that are actually far more pro-innovation and pro-market without actually having to buy into the mercantilist strategy others have. That ultimately is a dead end as well.
Ken, one quick thing though. There's some new research that I find fascinating, partly because we did some of it. but there's a study that we did, it's on our website, it's looking under TASI, because it was article. I responded to Greg's on, and then also Dan Luria in Michigan. I also, I believe, Sue Halpern. I think that's who did that study. All of us came up with, I think, a very striking and troubling, interesting finding, which is that the current BEA output measures of U.S. manufacturing are dramatically overstated. And so, Grant, I used to believe that, because that's what the numbers tell you, that output per GDP has not gone down. I think the BEA numbers are dramatically overstated, and I don't know enough time to go into that, but in our analysis of those numbers, and Sue Halpern and Dan Luria, all three independent studies, we suggest that U.S. manufacturing output has gone down about 30% of their GDP in the last decade, as opposed to what they say, which is that it's stable. And that, to me, is a critical question to get right. We simply don't know.
There's no doubt.
And if it's more there, then it's
kind of... for example, one of the sectors within the manufacturing sector that has grown dramatically is petroleum processing. Well, that means we're importing more oil and having to process it. Now, does that mean we're stronger or weaker as a result? It's one of the issues, but it's one of, I mean, you're right.
Ken Jarbo, Athena Alliance. One of the same people who've been making those speeches since the 1980s. And I think, Grant, when I hear that, unfortunately, that's what we heard 30 years ago. If we don't pay attention, we will lose it. And I think we've been slowly losing it. Which gets me to the other speech I used to give 30 years ago, 25 years ago, when we did the Uruguay round. I was basically on record saying I thought that this was going to be the last multinational round that we would have, multilateral, multi-issue round, because the dynamics of the gap on the WTO, as you said, was all driven towards reducing tariffs. So I reduce my tariff, you reduce yours, and there was a self-reinforcing dynamic there. When we talk about the rules, as you guys have been talking about, there's no self-reinforcing dynamic. So given that, what's our mechanism for going after the rules?
Honestly, Ken, I think it's to work. I'm not so good on technology here. But the first thing is that, you know, the reason where the WTO is right now, I think, isn't so much of a pure focus on tariffs, although I think that's a lot of what it's done. It's because transactional costs have gone down generally, including by virtue of the Uruguay round. But technology and the political changes after the Cold War simply leveled the plane. And what that means is there's no requirement for vertical integration in many industries that used to exist. And if you think about the way we have structured trade policy and structured our trade negotiations, including most importantly within the WTO and the GATT system, it actually relies on the idea of vertical integration and arm's length sales between the independent buyer and seller. It's just not the world we live in any longer. And so the way I would look at it is the WTO and the way that we normally bargain can is actually no longer apposite to the challenges that American companies face. And this shouldn't be a great surprise that American companies are looking elsewhere in some respects to find the way forward. Because the WTO structure at its core is still based on something which they're seeing less and less themselves. Now, that's why I say, I think what we really have to do is focus on trying to create a common commercial environment where you really say, how do we align the incentives so that we are fostering as a community of nations this entrepreneurial innovation that I think Stephen posits so well in the report and that Rob has really spent his life talking about, because it's a gift that creates a positive sum outcome. That should be that self-reinforcing cycle of a little bit like we had with tariffs. But it requires this leap on the part of policymakers away from an idea of a Westphalian state system and the idea that we're still living in this world of arm's length sales to embrace the idea of a world economy based on creative destruction, and that a lot of what governments have to do is facilitate the adaptation and the change that Marcus was talking about. And that really does mean talking about fundamental principles about how you organize your economy and your society. That's why I would suggest you got to do that on sort of a sub-multilateral basis. I don't think we can do that in the G20. And I think particularly in Asia, what it means is trying to gather a group of states that are now disaffected from China, both because of the effect that China's policies has had on the regional supply chain, as well as they want to diversify the debt, so they want to keep the United States engaged. It gives us a point of leverage to do something in Asia that would invite China and India in, but create a much more powerful dynamic in the direction that the report suggests we all ought to be moving.
Thank you.
Yes, sir, right here.
Yeah. And I have several questions. The first one is that, do you think that the global production relocation is a natural process, or it was seduced by countries like China, India? So that is the first question. And the second one is, was United States the major driving force for the global liberalization, or it was China, India who drive that? And the third one is that a lot of your argument was the masking, the service sector was underdeveloped, while the trading sector developed much faster. But according to my study or experience, and the domestic service sector was not underdeveloped, and it's just equalized. So then where does that kind of understanding come from? And my last question is that, when we just want to find a solution for everything, is that evilize other partners and also implant this kind of protectionism policy? Is that from Schumpeter that we say we need a destructive innovation? Is this an innovation or is it just destruction? Thank you.
Those are a lot of questions.
Four PhD theses.
Let me just do the first one, and then is China and India sort of the cause of globalization? Clearly the answer is no. Globalization is an inherent fact, partly because of technological evolution, the development of the container, containerization, and ICT, and all that stuff. So I don't think anybody is stating that somehow China, there wouldn't be trade, and there wouldn't be globalization, and there wouldn't be lost jobs if it wasn't for China. I think the issue, though, is the nature of that and the structural nature of that and the systemic large trade deficits. I think that's the issue. At least from our official position, ITIF, is we're total pro-globalists. Global integration, global trade is a wonderful thing, but it really needs to be based on a set of rules that allow countries to capture their natural competitive advantage and help to build on that. So
I think you can definitely say that China's policies have had a direct effect activity from the United States to their country. In the article you mentioned, the Sun and Xi, they look at the shift of manufacturing in certain sectors from China from 1998 to 2008. So whereas in 1998, the U.S. produced 32% of the world's printed circuit boards, by 2008 that fallen to 8%, and the experience in China had been reversed. They grew from 7% to about 30%. You saw the exact same thing with machine tools, semiconductors, and clean energy production. So whereas in 1998, the U.S. produced about a third of the world's solar cells, we now produce about 12%. China's share has gone from 7% to 33%, and it's expected that by 2011, they'll have two-thirds of the world's solar cells production. So I think you can definitely see that their policies are having the intended effect of moving productive activity to their shores.
I would also add, by the way, we often do debates here, and I don't mean that this should be a gang up on China, because that's not what we're trying to do, but also, if you're interested, or are there other folks, we would be happy to, I think it'd be very interesting for us to hold a debate. We'll have to see if there are a couple of Chinese colleagues who want to present and discuss, because I do think there's obviously a lot of mutual learning that can go on.
Right here, sir.
Sorry, Rob. Yeah. Before you go on, yeah. To your point, what I heard underlying that was, is an attempt to go after these policies an effort to prevent China from finding a new comparative advantage? So it's not simply the final assembly point for manufacturing in Asia. And that clearly is not what it's designed to do. But what that requires you to understand is that comparative advantage is not driven by the choices governments make. It's driven by the choices entrepreneurs make. And we don't spend a lot of time thinking about the trade world. We kind of take comparative advantage as a given. But that's precisely why what you want for China, like you want for everywhere else, is the idea that the entrepreneurs are free to drive what China's comparative advantage would be, not the choices made by the government setting standards for the benefit of the red chips to take it to Huawei or whoever else it might be to take advantage of their size, their scale, to then shift employment to China. That's different than trying to allow the Chinese entrepreneurs to try and drive future employment opportunities and a more balanced approach to growth, both within the economy and globally.
Yes, sir, right here.
Joshua Wu, U.S. Commerce Department, China Desk. We've been working on innovation discussions with China for the last few years under strategic economic dialogue. Your suggestion number four was interesting when you say stop playing whack-a-mole, talk about broader principles, and it's been interesting to see sort of doing both at the same time, you know, at a very senior level, talking about broad principles, and individually trying to raise some of the issues we have a problem with. I think when we get to the incentive part that Grant mentioned is where it gets a little tricky. You know, they keep coming out with things, and every meeting we keep raising them. I'd be curious to hear your recommendations on some of these incentives, thinking beyond the multilateral perspective, which will take a couple of years to get to that point. But in a bilateral approach, what would be some incentives that you would recommend, sort of in between high level and platform, that would create some common platform for them?
You know, I mean, there's one thing that you have that's a wasting asset as a bargaining chip, non-market economics is. And one of the keys to talking with China is to offer something. Now the reality is you take what's left of non-market economy status, you put it on the table in return for some capital account flexibility and currency flexibility. And what you say, which is tied directly to the standards under the statute for non-market economy, is that liberalization on their part drives many of the changes that would satisfy the statutory standards, particularly the one about free capital. So there are things you can find to put on the table that offer incentives. But I want to be clear, the institutional incentives I was talking about are actually the incentives you create in the underlying rules within your own country as well as in other countries. And then China will find the pull of that kind of environment as something they want to be a part of. That's not actually the dialogue we're likely to succeed at bilaterally with the Chinese. I also think it's one of the reasons why in the G20, as long as we're accusing them of currency manipulation, we probably won't make much progress in trade either.
So I think we have time for one more question here.
I guess my question is for Dennis. Oh, sorry, my name is Josh Mia with the Roswell Group. I guess my question is, it would be most targeted towards some of the comments that you made, Grant, but open to anybody. So in the discussion of increasing domestic productivity and encouraging entrepreneurship, one of the things that I wonder is what exactly is the entrepreneur? Like, who is it? Because in particular, I mean, folks in my generation, like 20, 25, that area, there's a lot of entrepreneurship, but then with the way the economy shifted in the past few years, there's like this massive glut of middle-aged folks and people maybe around like late 20s and before around 45 or so that don't feel like they have the skills that can transfer to something else where you could do something meaningful in a domestic trade sector or non-trade sector. So I guess my question is, so when you talk about changing the incentives domestically and having some kind of common commercial agreement and whatnot, it seems like a big question is what do you do with these lower skilled workers or workers who just don't have the directly applicable skills to a high tech sector or financial services sector, and where do you put them? Because there's just millions of people who maybe previously worked in manufacturing with welders or whatnot, and there's no space. So I've heard, and more specifically, I've heard folks talk about the importance of worker training programs, maybe teaching people how to run their own savings accounts to become and increase their sort of financial acumen. But in general, what are those skills that we can train people to so that we get the kind of incentives we're talking about?
1 minute, Grant.
Yeah, ironically, I wrote a book about
this. Read Grant's book.
Yeah.
The title is?
Globalization of American Work. It's about negotiating a new social contract. But the real point is to say that the first thing you have to do, and I would say this is true of our policies generally on a strategy that Rob and Steve have talked about, is getting out of our own way. You'd be surprised to know that the U.S. tax code penalizes you if you actually want to train for a different career. So if you train for your current career, you can deduct the expenses and your taxes. If you're smart enough to know that the change is coming, you decide you want to do something to train yourself fundamentally different, sorry, you're out of luck. That's insane. It's a non-adjustment policy. And so simply going systematically through what we do now and eliminating the obstacles for people to create their own future would be a good first step. But I'm completely supportive of the idea that to get to where Mark wants to go is that we actually need a series of government programs to try and facilitate the change. And frankly, it's not just people my age. And I'm sorry, I thought you said massive gut rather than massive blood. But the reality is that we have a mismatch between our educational system and what the world requires. And you don't have to go farther than Cleveland to understand this. LPV and Cleveland Plus Mining no longer dominate that economy. Cleveland Clinic does. And the Cleveland Clinic has to import workers from other states. If you look at where the jobs have gone in Ohio, they haven't gone to China. By and large, they've gone to Indiana. And a lot of this has to do with the mix of policies at a state level as well as a federal level, and some of it has to go with what kind of entrepreneurial innovation you're trying to create in these local and regional communities. And there are states that are failing in terms of trying to educate people for that kind of economy. And so it's really across the board, it seems. It's not just the guys who are 55.
I have a brief comment on that. This week did a study in April that said there were 1 million jobs in the U.S. that have gone unfulfilled over the past 4 months because employers can't find the right skills in our own economy for them. So there's some number of jobs are out there that we just can't fill.
Actually, it was 1 million and one. Because we have one of those. trying to find an economist who actually has an understanding of this. We have to
just to give you an example, I was at a low-tech high school last Tuesday. In western Pennsylvania, in a traditional manufacturing area that is actually thriving relative to the rest of the economy, in manufacturing, there were more students in the low-tech cosmetology than there were in the manufacturing program. Now, somehow the community incentives and the community ethos has to change. I have no problem with people going into cosmetology, and in fact, those were all women, and you wouldn't expect a lot of those women to go into manufacturing. But the point is, from a national economic point of view, the value added of a cosmetology worker is very little. The potential value added of a manufacturing worker is very high. So, you know, we have somehow our incentives also wrong.
I'm tempted to say I haven't spent much time in western Pennsylvania.
I actually think it was a cosmology program.
Yes.
It's a little different, so. Well, I want to thank Bruce and Grant Marcus for really great, great comments, and thank you all, and I know they'll be here for a couple minutes if you have questions or comments for them, so please join me in thanking Grant.